I'm Lewis. Welcome to a little storytelling that we're doing. If you haven't noticed, Danny and I have some of the most trouble in the world that anybody has ever had with trying to get our schedules to line up, which is a huge pain in the ass. However, it does mean that I get to do this incredibly self-indulgent thing and read a story to you on the regular, so that should be nice. Today, I'm going to be reading Quitters Inc. by Stephen King from his book Night Shift, which is a collection of short stories. It occurred to me, I did not buy this book new. This is an old, old copy. It appears, I think I must have bought it second hand, but there's no price written in it or anything. So I guess it cost me like £1 or something, but it's really good. If you see a copy of this in a bookshop or anything like that, get it. It's really good. I took it with me on my honeymoon and I was petrified. It was brilliant. Yes, Quitters Inc. It's a short story. It's a bit scary. I hope you enjoy it very, very much. And without further ado, let's get into it. Morrison was waiting for someone who was hung up in the air traffic jam over Kennedy International when he saw a familiar face at the end of the bar and walked down. Jimmy? Jimmy McCann. It was. A little heavier than when Morrison had seen him at the Atlanta exhibition the year before, but otherwise he looked awesomely fit. In college he'd been a thin, pallid chain smoker buried behind huge horn-rimmed glasses. He had apparently switched to contact lenses. Dick Morrison? Yeah, you look great. He extended his hand, and they shook. So do you, McCann said, but Morrison knew it was a lie. He had been overworking, overeating, and smoking too much. What are you drinking? Bourbon and bitters, Morrison said. He hooked his feet around a bar stool and lighted a cigarette. Meeting someone, Jimmy? No. Going to Miami for a conference. A heavy client. Bills $6 million. I'm supposed to hold his hand because we lost out on a big special next spring. Are you still with Krager and Barton? Executive Veep now. Fantastic! Congratulations! When did all this happen? He tried to tell himself that the little worm of jealousy in his stomach was just acid indigestion. He pulled out a roll of antacid pills and crunched one in his mouth. Last August. Something happened that changed my life. He looked speculatively at Morrison and sipped his drink. You might be interested. My God, Morrison thought with an inner voice. Jimmy McCann's got religion. Sure, he said, and gulped his drink when it came. I wasn't in very good shape, McCann said. Personal problems with Sharon. My dad died, heart attack. And I'd developed this hacking cough. Bobby Krager dropped by my office one day and gave me a fatherly little pep talk. Do you remember what those are like? Yeah. He had worked at Krager and Barton for 18 months before joining the Morton Agency. Get your butt in gear or get your butt out. McCann laughed. Yeah, you know it. Well, to put the capper on it, the doc told me I had an incipient ulcer. He told me to quit smoking, McCann grimaced. Might as well tell me to quit breathing. Morrison nodded in perfect understanding. Non-smokers could afford to be smug. He looked at his own cigarette with distaste and stubbed it out, knowing he would be lighting another in 5 minutes. Did you quit? He asked. Yes, I did. At first I didn't think I'd be able to. I was cheating like hell. Then I met a guy who told me about an outfit over on 46th Street. Specialists. I said, well, what do I have to lose? And I went over. I haven't smoked since. Morrison's eyes widened. What'd they do? Fill you full of some drug? No. He'd taken out his wallet and was rummaging through it. Here it is, I know he had one kicking round. He laid a plain white business card out on the bar between them. Quitters Inc. Stop going up in smoke. 237 East 46th Street. Treatments by appointment. Keep it, if you want, McCann said. They'll cure you, guaranteed. How? I can't tell you, McCann said. Why not? It's part of the contract they make you sign. Anyway, they tell you how it works when they interview you. You signed a contract? McCann nodded. And on the basis of that... Yep, he smiled at Morrison, who thought, well, it's happened. Jim McCann has joined the smug bastards. Why the great secrecy of this outfit is so fantastic? How come I've never seen any spots on TV or billboards or magazine ads or... They get all the clients they can handle by word of mouth. You're an advertising man, Jimmy. You can't believe that. I do, McCann said. They have a 98% cure rate. Wait a second, Morrison said. He motioned for another drink and lit a cigarette. Do these guys strap you down and make you smoke until you throw up? Nope. Give you something so that you get sick every time you light? No, it's nothing like that. Go and see for yourself. He He gestured at Morrison's cigarette. You don't really like that, do you? No, but stopping really changed things for me, McCann said. I don't suppose it's the same for everyone, but with me it was just like dominoes falling over. I felt better, and my relationship with Sharon improved. I had more energy and my job performance picked up. Look, you've got my curiosity aroused. Can't you just... I'm sorry, Dick. I really can't talk about it. His voice was firm. Did you put on any weight? For a moment, he thought Jimmy McCann looked almost grim. Yes, a little too much, in fact, but I took it off again. I'm about right now. I was skinny before. Flight 206, now boarding at gate 9, the loudspeaker announced. That's me, McCann said, getting up. He tossed a 5 on the bar. Have another, if you like. And think about what I said, Dick. Really. And then he was gone, making his way through the crowd to the escalators. Morrison picked up the card, looked at it thoughtfully, then tucked it away in his wallet and forgot it. The card fell out of his wallet and onto another bar a month later. He had left the office early and had come here to drink the afternoon away. Things had not been going so well at the Morton Agency. In fact, things were bloody horrible. He gave Henry a 10 to pay for his drink, then picked up the small card and reread it. 237 East 46th Street was only 2 blocks over. It was a cool, sunny October day outside, and maybe, just for chuckles. When Henry bought his change, he finished his drink and then went for a walk. Quitters Inc. was in a new building where the monthly rent on office space was probably close to Morrison's yearly salary. From the directory in the lobby, it looked to him like their offices took up one whole floor, and that spelled money. Lots of it. He took the elevator up and stepped off into a lushly carpeted foyer, and from there into a gracefully appointed reception room with a wide window that looked out on the scurrying bugs below. Three men and one woman, sat in the chairs all along the walls, reading magazines. Business types, all of them. Morrison went to the desk. A friend gave me this, he said, passing the card to a receptionist. I guess you'd say he's an alumnus. She smiled and rolled a form into her typewriter. What is your name, sir? Richard Morrison. Clack, clackety clack. But very muted clacks. The typewriter was an IBM. Your address? 29 Maple Lane, Clinton, New York. Married? Yes. Children? One. He thought of Alvin and frowned slightly. One was the wrong word. A half might be better. Who recommended us to you, Mr. Morrison? An old school friend, James McCann. Very good. We have a seat. It's been a very busy day. All right. He sat between the woman, who was wearing a severe blue suit, and a young executive type wearing herringbone jacket and modish sideburns. He took out his pack of cigarettes, looked around, and saw there were no ashtrays. He put the pack away again. That was all right. He would see this little game through and then light up while he was leaving. He might even tap some ashes on their maroon shag rug if they made him wait long enough. He picked up a copy of Time and began to leaf through it. He was called a quarter of an hour later, and the woman in the blue suit. His nicotine center was speaking quite loudly now. A man who had come in after him took out a cigarette case, snapped it open, saw there were no ashtrays, and put it away, looking a little guilty, Morrison thought. It made him feel better. At last the receptionist gave him a sunny smile and said, "Go right in, Mr. Morrison." Morrison walked through the door beyond her desk and found himself in an indirectly lit hallway. A heavy-set man with white hair that looked phony shook his hand, smiled affably, and said, "Follow me, Mr. Morrison." He led Morrison past a number of closed, unmarked doors, and then opened one of them about halfway down the hall with a key. Beyond the door was an austere little room, walled with drilled white cork panels. The only furnishings were a desk with a chair on either side. There was what appeared to be a small, oblong window in the wall behind the desk, but it was covered with a short green curtain. There was a picture on the wall to Morrison's left, a tall man with iron-grey hair. He was holding a sheet of paper in one hand, and he looked vaguely familiar. "I'm Vic Donati," the heavy-set man said. "If you decide to go ahead with our program, I'll be in charge of your case." "Pleased to know you," Morrison said. He wanted a cigarette very badly. "Have a seat." Donati put the receptionist's form on the desk, and then drew another form from the desk drawer. He looked directly into Morrison's eyes. "Do you want to quit smoking?" Morrison cleared his throat, crossed his legs, and tried to think of a way to equivocate. He couldn't. Yes, he said. "Will you sign this?" He gave Morrison the form. He scanned it quickly. The undersigned agrees not to divulge the methods or techniques or etc., etc. "Sure," he said, and Donati put a pen in his hand. He scratched his name, and Donati signed below it. A moment later, the paper disappeared back into the desk drawer. "Well," he thought ironically, "I've taken the pledge." He had taken it before. Once it had lasted for 2 whole days. Good, Donati said. We don't bother with propaganda here, Mr. Morrison. Questions of health or expense or social grace. We have no interest in why you want to stop smoking. We are pragmatists. Good, Morrison said blankly. We employ no drugs. We employ no Dale Carnegie and people to sermonize you. We recommend no special diet, and we accept no payment until you have stopped smoking for 1 year. My God, Morrison said. Mr. McCann didn't tell you that. No. How is Mr. McCann, by the way? Is he well? He's fine. Wonderful. Excellent. Now, just a few questions, Mr. Morrison. These are somewhat personal, but I assure you that your answers will be held in the strictest confidence. Yes? Morrison asked, noncommittally. What is your wife's name? Lucinda Morrison. Her maiden name was Ramsay. Do you love her? Morrison looked up sharply, but Donati was looking at him blandly. Yes, of course, he said. Have you ever had marital problems? A separation, perhaps? What has that got to do with kicking the habit? Morrison asked. He sounded a little angrier than he had intended, but he wanted, well, he needed a cigarette. A great deal, Donati said. Just bear with me. No, nothing like that. Although things had been a little tense lately. You just have the one child? Yes, Alvin. He's in a private school. And which school is it? That, Morrison said grimly, I'm not going to tell you. All right, Donati said agreeably. He smiled disarmingly at Morrison. All your questions will be answered tomorrow at your first treatment. How nice, Morrison said and stood. One final question. You haven't had a cigarette for over an hour. How do you feel? Fine, Morrison lied. Just fine. Good for you, Donati exclaimed. He stepped around the desk and opened the door. Enjoy them tonight. After tomorrow, you will never smoke again. Is that right? Mr. Morrison, Donati said solemnly, we guarantee it. He was sitting in the outer office of Quitters Inc. the next day, promptly at 3. He had spent most of the day swinging between skipping the appointment the receptionist had made for him on the way out and going in a spirit of mulish cooperation. Throw your best pitch at me, Buster. In the end, something Jimmy McCann had said convinced him to keep the appointment. It changed my whole life. God knew his own life could do with some changing. And then there was his own curiosity. Before going up in the elevator, he smoked a cigarette down to the filter. Too damn bad if it's the last one, he thought. It tasted horrible. The wait in the outer office was shorter this time. When the receptionist told him to go in, Donati was waiting. He offered his hand and smiled, and to Morrison the smile looked almost predatory. He began to feel a little tense, and that made him want a cigarette. Come with me, Donati said, and led the way down to the small room. He sat behind the desk again, and Morrison took the other chair. I'm very glad you came, Donati said. A great many prospective clients never show up after the initial interview. They discover they don't want to quit as badly as they thought. It's going to be a pleasure to work with you on this. When does the treatment start? Hypnosis, he was thinking. It must be hypnosis. Oh, it already has. It started when we shook hands in the hall. Do you have cigarettes with you, Mr. Morrison? Yes. May I have them, please? Shrugging, Morrison handed Donati his pack. There were only 2 or 3 left in it anyway. Donati put the pack on the desk. Then, smiling into Morrison's eyes, he curled his right hand into a fist and began to hammer it down on the pack of cigarettes, which twisted and flattened. A broken cigarette end flew out. Tobacco crumbs spilled. The sound of Donati's fist was very loud in the closed room. The smile remained on his face in spite of the force of the blows, and Morrison was chilled by it. Probably just the effect they want to inspire, he thought. At last, Donati ceased pounding. He picked up the pack, a twisted and battered ruin. You wouldn't believe the pleasure that gives me, he says, and dropped the pack into the wastebasket. Even after 3 years in the business, it still pleases me. As a treatment, it leaves something to be desired, Morrison said mildly. It's a newsstand in the lobby of this very building, and they sell all the brands. As you say, Donati said. He folded his hand. Your son, Alvin Dawes Morrison, is in the Patterson School for Handicapped Children. Born with cranial brain damage, tested IQ of 46. Your wife... How did you find that out? Morrison barked. He was startled and angry. You've got no goddamn right to go poking around my... We all know a lot about you, Donati said smoothly. But, as I said, it will all be held in the strictest confidence. I am getting out of here, Morrison said thinly. He stood up. Stay a bit longer. Morrison looked at him closely. Donati wasn't upset. In fact, he looked a little amused. The face of a man who has seen this reaction scores of times, maybe hundreds. All right, but it better be good. Oh, it is. Donati leaned back. I told you we were pragmatists here. As pragmatists, we have to start by realizing how difficult it is to cure an addiction to tobacco. The relapse rate is almost 85%. The relapse rate for heroin addicts is lower than that. It is an extraordinary problem. Extraordinary. Morrison glanced into the wastebaskets. One of the cigarettes, although twisted, still looked smokable. Donati laughed good-naturedly, reached into the wastebasket, and broke it between his fingers. State legislatures sometimes hear a request that the prison systems do away with the weekly cigarette ration. Such proposals are invariably defeated. In a few cases where they have passed, there have been fierce prison riots. Riots, Mr. Morrison, imagine it. I, Morrison said, am not surprised. But consider the implications. When you put a man in prison, you take away any normal sex life, you take away his liquor, his politics, his freedom of movement. No riots, or few, in comparison to the number of prisons. But when you take away his cigarettes, wham, bam! He slammed his fist on the desk for emphasis. During World War I, when no one on the German home front could get cigarettes, the sight of German aristocrats picking guts out of the gutter was a common one. During World War II, many American women turned to pipes when they were unable to obtain cigarettes. A fascinating problem for the true pragmatist, Mr. Morrison. Could we get to the treatment? Momentarily. Step over here, please. Donati had risen and was standing by the green curtains Morrison had noticed yesterday. Donati drew the curtains, discovering a rectangular window that looked into a bare room. No, not quite bare. There was a rabbit on the floor, eating pellets out of a dish. It's a pretty bunny, Morrison commented. Indeed. Watch him. Donati pressed a button by the windowsill. The rabbit stopped eating and began to hop about crazily. It seemed to leap higher each time its feet struck the floor. Its fur stood out spikily in all directions. Its eyes were wild. Stop that! You're electrocuting him! Donati released the button. Far from it. There's a very low-yield charge in the floor. Watch the rabbit, Mr. Morrison. The rabbit was crouched about 10 feet away from the dish of pellets. His nose wriggled. All at once, he hopped away into a corner. If the rabbit gets a jolt often enough while he's eating, Donati said, he makes the association very quickly. Eating causes pain, therefore I won't eat. A few more shocks, and the rabbit will starve to death in front of his food. It's called aversion training. Light dawned in Morrison's head. No thanks. He started for the door. Wait, please, Mr. Morrison. Morrison didn't pause. He grasped the doorknob and felt it slip solidly through his hand. Unlock this. Mr. Morrison, if you'll just sit down, unlock this door or I'll have the cops on you before you can say Marlborough Man. Sit down. The voice was as cold as shaved ice. Morrison looked at Donati. His brown eyes were muddy and frightening. My God, he thought. I'm locked in here with a psycho. He licked his lips. He wanted a cigarette more than he ever had in his life. Let me explain the treatment in more detail, Donati said. You don't understand, Morrison said with a counterfeit patience. I don't want the treatment. I've decided against it. No, Mr. Morrison, you're the one who doesn't understand. You don't have any choice. When I told you the treatment had already begun, I was speaking the literal truth. I thought you would have tipped to that by now. You're crazy, Morrison said wonderingly. Nope, only a pragmatist. Let me tell you all about the treatment. Sure, Morrison said. As long as you understand that as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to buy 5 packs of cigarettes and smoke them all on the way to the police station. He suddenly realized he was biting his thumbnail, sucking on it, and made himself stop. As you wish. But I think you'll change your mind when you see the whole picture. Morrison said nothing. He sat down again and folded his hands. For the first month of the treatment, our operatives will have you under constant supervision, Donati said. You'll be able to spot some of them. Not all. But they'll always be with you. Always. If they see you smoke a cigarette, I get a call. And I suppose you bring me here and do the old rabbit trick, Morrison said. He tried to sound cold and sarcastic, but he suddenly felt horribly frightened. This was a nightmare. Oh, no, Donati said. Your wife gets the rabbit trick, not you. Morrison looked at him dumbly. Donati smiled. You, he said, get to watch. After Donati let him out, Morrison walked for over 2 hours in a complete daze. It was another fine day, but he didn't notice. The monstrousness of Donati's smiling face blotted out all else. You'll see, he said. A pragmatic problem demands pragmatic solutions. You must realize we have your best interests at heart. Quitters Inc., according to Donati, was a sort of foundation, a non-profit organization begun by the man in the wall portrait. The gentleman had been extremely successful in several family businesses, including slot machines, massage parlors, numbers, and a brisk, although clandestine, trade between New York and Turkey. Mort Three Fingers Minnelli had been a heavy smoker, up in the three-pack-a-day range. The paper he was holding in the picture was a doctor's diagnosis, lung cancer. Mort had died in 1970, after endowing Quitters Inc. with family funds. "We try to keep as close to breaking even as possible," Donati had said, "but we're more interested in helping our fellow man, and of course, it's a great tax angle." The treatment was chillingly simple. A first offence, and Cindy would be brought to what Donati called the rabbit room. A second offence, and Morrison would get the dose. On a third offence, both of them would be brought in together. A fourth offence would show grave cooperation problems and would require sterner measures. An operative would be sent to Alvin's school to work the boy over. "Imagine," Donati said, smiling, "how horrible it will be for the boy. He wouldn't understand it, even if someone explained. He'll only know someone is hurting him because Daddy was bad. He'll be very frightened." "You bastard," Morrison said helplessly. He felt close to tears. "You dirty, filthy bastard." "Don't misunderstand," Donati said. He was smiling sympathetically. "I'm sure it won't happen. 40% of our clients never have to be disciplined at all, and only 10% have more than 3/4 from grace. Those are reassuring figures, aren't they?" Morrison didn't find them reassuring. He found them terrifying. "Of course, if you transgress a fifth time..." "What do you mean?" Donati beamed. "The room for you, and your wife, and a second beating for your son, and a beating for your wife." Morrison, driven beyond the point of rational consideration, lunged over the desk at Donati. Donati moved with amazing speed for a man who had apparently been completely relaxed. He shoved the chair backwards and drove both of his feet over the desk into Morrison's belly. Gagging and coughing, Morrison staggered backward. "Sit down, Mr. Morrison," Donati said benignly. "Let's talk this over like rational men." When he could get his breath, Morrison did as he was told. Nightmares had to end sometime, didn't they? Quitters Inc., Donati had explained further, operated on a 10-step punishment scale. Steps 6, 7, and 8 consisted of further trips to the rabbit room and increased voltage, and more serious beatings. The 9th step would be the breaking of his son's arms. "And the 10th? Morrison asked, his mouth dry. Donati shook his head, sadly. "Then we give up, Mr. Morrison. You become part of the unregenerate 2%. "You really give up?" "In a manner of speaking." He opened one of the desk drawers and laid a silenced 45 on the desk. He smiled into Morrison's eyes. "But even the unregenerate 2% never smoke again, we guarantee." The Friday night movie was Bullet, one of Cindy's favourites. But after an hour of Morrison's mutterings and fidgetings, her concentration was broken. "What's the matter with you?" she asked during station identification. "Nothing. Everything," he growled. "I'm giving up smoking." She laughed. "Since when? 5 minutes ago?" "Since 3 o'clock this afternoon." "You really haven't had a cigarette since then?" "No," he said, and began to gnaw his thumbnail. It was ragged, down to the quick. "That's wonderful. Whatever made you decide to quit?" "You," he said, and Alvin. Her eyes widened, and when the movie came back on, she didn't notice. She came over, looked at the empty ashtray by his right hand, and then into his eyes. "Are you really trying to quit, Dick?" "Really. And if I go to the cops," he added mentally, "the local goon squad will be around to rearrange your face, Cindy." "I'm glad. Even if you don't make it, we both thank you for the thought, Dick." "Oh, I'll make it," he said, looking into the muddy, homicidal look that had come from Donati's eyes when he kicked him in the stomach. He slept badly that night, dozing in and out of sleep. Around 3 o'clock, he woke up completely. His craving for a cigarette was like a low-grade fever. He went downstairs and to his study. The room was in the middle of the house. No windows. He slid open the top drawer of his desk and looked in, fascinated by the cigarette box. He looked around and licked his lips. "Constant supervision during the first month," Donati had said. 18 hours a day during the next two, which he would never know which 18. During the fourth month, the month when most clients backslid, the service would return to 24 hours a day. Then 12 hours of broken surveillance each day for the rest of the year. After that, random surveillance for the rest of the client's life. For the rest of his life. "We may audit you every other month," Donati said, "or every other day. Or constantly for 1 week, 2 years from now. The point is, you won't know. If you smoke, you'll be gambling with loaded dice. Are they watching? Are they picking up my wife or sending a man off to my son right now? Beautiful, isn't it? And if you do sneak a smoke, it'll taste awful. It'll taste like your son's blood. But they couldn't be watching now in the dead of night in his own study. The house was grave quiet. He looked at the cigarettes in the box for almost 2 minutes, unable to tear his gaze away. Then he went to the study door, peered out into the empty hall, and went back to look at the cigarettes some more. A horrible picture came, his life stretching before him and not a cigarette to be found. How in the name of God was he ever going to be able to make another tough presentation to a wary client without that cigarette burning nonchalantly between his fingers as he approached the charts and layouts? How would he be able to endure Cindy's endless garden shows without a cigarette? How could he even get up in the morning and face the day without a cigarette to smoke as he drank his coffee and read the paper? He cursed himself for getting into this. He cursed Donati, and most of all, he cursed Jimmy McCann. How could he have done it? That son of a bitch had known! His hands trembled in their desire to get hold of Jimmy Judas McCann. Stealthily, he glanced around the study again. He reached into the drawer and brought out a cigarette. He caressed it, fondled it. What was that old slogan? So round, so firm, so fully packed. Truer words had never been spoken. He put the cigarette in his mouth and then paused, cocking his head. Had there been the slightest noise from the closet? A faint shifting? Surely not, but another mental image. That rabbit hopping crazily in the grip of electricity. The thought of Cindy in that room. He listened desperately and heard nothing. He told himself that all he had to do was go to the closet door and yank it open, but he was too afraid of what he might find. He went back to bed, but didn't sleep for a long time. In spite of how lousy he felt in the morning, breakfast tasted good. After a moment's hesitation, he followed his customary bowl of cornflakes with scrambled eggs. He was grumpily washing out the pan when Cindy came downstairs in her robe. "Richard Morrison! You haven't eaten an egg for breakfast since Hector was a pup!" Morrison grunted. He considered saying "since Hector was a pup" to be one of Cindy's stupidest sayings, on par with "I should smile and kiss a pig." "Have you smoked yet?" she asked, pouring off an orange juice. "No." "You'll be back on them by noon," she proclaimed airily. "I'm not a goddamn help you are," he rasped, rounding on her. "You and anyone else who doesn't smoke, you all think..." Never mind. He expected her to be angry, but she was looking at him with something like wonder. "You're really serious," she said. "You really are." "You bet I am. You'll never know how serious, I hope." "Poor baby," she said, going to him. "You look like death warmed over. But I'm very proud." Morrison held her tightly. Scenes from the life of Richard Morrison, October to November. Morrison and a crony from Larkin Studios at Jack Dempsey's bar. Crony offers a cigarette. Morrison grips his glass a little more tightly and says, "I'm quitting." Crony laughs and says, "I give you a week." Morrison waiting for the morning train, looking over the top of the Times at a young man in a blue suit. He sees the young man almost every morning now, and sometimes at other places. At Undays, where he is meeting a client, looking at 45s in Sam Goody's, where Morrison is looking for a Sam Cooke album. Once in a foursome behind Morrison's group at the local golf course. Morrison getting drunk at a party, wanting a cigarette, but not quite drunk enough to take one. Morrison visiting his son, bringing him a large ball that squeaked when you squeezed it. His son's slobbering, delighted kiss, somehow not as repulsive as before. Hugging his son tightly, realizing what Donati and his colleagues had so cynically realized before him. Love is the most pernicious drug of all. Let the romantics debate its existence. Pragmatists accept and use it. Morrison losing the physical compulsion to smoke little by little, but never quite losing the psychological craving or the need to have something in his mouth. Cough drops, lifesavers, a toothpick, poor substitutes, all of them. And finally, Morrison hung up in a colossal traffic jam in the Midtown Tunnel. Darkness, horns blaring, air stinking, traffic hopelessly snarled, and suddenly thumbing open the glove compartment and seeing the half-opened pack of cigarettes in there. He looked at them for a moment, then snatched one and lit it with the dashboard lighter. "If anything happens, it's Cindy's fault," he told himself defiantly. "I told her to get rid of all the damn cigarettes." The first drag made him cough smoke out furiously, the second made his eyes water, the third made him feel lightheaded and swoony. "It tastes awful," he thought. And on the heels of that, "Oh my God, what am I doing?" Horns blatted impatiently behind him. Ahead, the traffic had begun to move again. He stubbed the cigarette out in the ashtray, opened both front windows, opened the vents, and then fanned the air helplessly like a kid who has just flushed his first butt down the john. He joined the traffic flow jerkily and drove home. "Cindy?" he called. "I'm home." No answer. "Cindy? Where are you, hon?" the phone rang and he pounced on it. "Hello, Cindy?" "Hello, Mr. Morrison," Donati said. He sounded pleasantly brisk and businesslike. "It seems we have a small business matter to attend to. Would 5 o'clock be convenient?" "Have you got my wife?"
"Yes, indeed."
Donati chuckled indulgently. "Look, let her go," Morrison babbled. "It won't happen again. It was a slip. Just a slip, that's all. I only had 3 drags, and for God's sake, it didn't even taste that good."
"Oh, that's a shame.
I'll count on you for 5, shall I?"
"Please," Morrison said, close to tears. "Please."
He was speaking to a deadline. At 5 p.m, the reception room was empty except for the secretary, who gave him a twinkly smile that ignored Morrison's pallor and dishevelled appearance. "Mr. Donati," she said into the intercom. "Mr. Morrison to see you." She nodded to Morrison. "Go right in." Donati was waiting outside the unmarked room with a man wearing a Smile sweatshirt and carrying a .38. He was built like an ape. "Listen," Morrison said to Donati, "we can work something out, can't we? I'll pay you. I'll..."
"Shut up," the man in the Smile sweatshirt said.
"It's good to see you," Donati said.
"Sorry it has to be under such adverse circumstances.
Will you come with me?
We'll make this as brief as possible. I can assure you your wife won't be hurt this time."
Morrison tensed himself to leap at Donati.
"Oh, come, come," Donati said, looking annoyed. "If you do that, Junk here is going to pistol whip you and your wife's still going to get it. Now where's the percentage in that?"
"I hope you rot in hell," he told Donati. Donati sighed. "If I had a nickel, for every time someone expressed a similar sentiment, I could retire. Let it be a lesson to you, Mr. Morrison. When a romantic tries to do a good thing and fails, they give him a medal. When a pragmatist succeeds, they wish him hell.
Shall we go?"
Junk motioned with the pistol. Morrison preceded them into the room. He felt numb. The small green curtain had been pulled. Junk prodded him with the gun.
"This is what being a witness at the gas chamber must have been like," he thought.
He looked in. Cindy was there, looking around bewilderedly.
"Cindy!" Morrison called miserably. "Cindy, they..."
"She can't hear or see you," Donati said.
"One-way glass."
"Well, let's get it over with. It really was a very small slip. I believe 30 seconds should be enough."
"Junk?" Junk pressed the button with one hand and kept the pistol jammed firmly into Morrison's back with the other. It was the longest 30 seconds of his life. When it was over, Donati put a hand on Morrison's shoulder and said, "Are you going to throw up?"
"No," Morrison said weakly. His forehead was against the glass. His legs were jelly.
"I don't think so." He turned around and saw that Junk was gone.
"Come with me," Donati said.
"Where?" Morrison asked apathetically.
"I think you have a few things to explain, don't you?"
"How can I face her? How can I tell her that I
think you're going to be surprised," Donati said. The room was empty, except for a sofa. Cindy was sitting on it, sobbing helplessly.
"Cindy," he said gently.
She looked up, her eyes magnified by tears.
"Dick?" she whispered. "Dick, oh God."
He held her tightly.
"Two men," she said against his chest. "In the house, and at first I thought they were burglars, and then I thought they were going to rape me, and then they took something, they took me someplace with a blindfold of my ears, and, oh, it was horrible."
"Shh," he said, "shh, shh, shh."
"But why?" he asked.
She asked, looking up at him.
"Why would they?"
"Because of me," he said. "I have a story to tell you, Cindy." When he had finished, he was silent a moment, and then said, "I suppose you hate me. I wouldn't blame you." He was looking at the floor. She took his face in both hands and turned it to hers.
"No," she said, "I don't hate you."
He looked at her in mute surprise.
"It was worth it," she said.
"God bless these people, they've let you out of prison."
"Do you mean that?"
"Yes," she said, and kissed him.
"Can we go home now? I feel much better, ever so much."
The phone rang one evening a week later, and when Morrison recognised Donati's voice, he said, "Your boys have got it wrong, I haven't even been near a cigarette." "We know that. We have a final matter to talk over. Can you stop by tomorrow afternoon?"
"Is it..."
"No, nothing serious. Bookkeeping, really. By the way, congratulations on your promotion."
"How did you know about that?"
"We're keeping tabs," Donati said noncommittally, and hung up. When they entered the small room, Donati said, "Don't look so nervous. No one's going to bite you. Step over here, please." Morrison saw an ordinary bathroom scale.
"Listen, I've gained a little weight, but..."
"Yes, 73% of our clients do. Step up, please." Morrison did, and tipped the scales at 174.
"Okay, fine, you can step off. How tall are you, Mr. Morrison?"
5'11".
"Okay, let's see." He pulled a small card laminated in plastic from his breast pocket.
"Well, that's not too bad. I'm going to write you a prescript for some highly illegal diet pills. Use them sparingly and according to directions. And I'm going to set your maximum weight at..." "Oh, let's see." He consulted the card again.
182. How does that sound? And since this is December 1st, I'll expect you the first of every month for a weigh-in. No problem if you can't make it, as long as you call in advance. And what happens if I go over 182? Donati smiled. We'll send someone over to your house to cut off your wife's little finger. He said, you can leave through this door, Mr. Morrison. Have a nice day. 8 months later, Morrison runs into the crony from Larkin Street Studios at Dempsey's Bar. Morrison is down to what Sindley proudly calls his fighting weight, 167. He works out 3 times a week and looks fit as a whipcord. The crony from Larkin, by comparison, looks like something the cat dragged in. Crony. Lord, how'd you ever stop? I'm locked into this damn habit tighter than Tilly. The crony stubs his cigarette out with real revulsion and drains his scotch. Morrison looks at him speculatively and then takes a small white business card out of his wallet. He puts it on the bar between them. You know, he says, these guys changed my life. 12 months later, Morrison receives a bill in the mail. The bill says, Quitters, Inc., 237 East 46th Street, New York, NY, 10017. One treatment, $2,500. Counselor, Victor Donati, $2,500. Electricity, 50 cents. Total, please pay this amount. $5,050. Those sons of bitches, he explodes. They charged me for the electricity they used to... Just pay it, she says, and kisses him. 20 months later. Quite by accident, Morrison and his wife meet the Jimmy McCanns at the Helen Hayes Theatre. Introductions are made all round. Jimmy looks as good, if not better, than he did on that day in the airport terminal so long ago. Morrison has never met his wife. She is pretty in the radiant way plain girls sometimes have when they are very, very happy. She offers her hand and Morrison shakes it. There is something odd about her grip, and halfway through the second act, he realizes what it was. The little finger on her right hand is missing. That story is, chilling, I think is the word. And I'm not just saying it because it's icy as anything outside. The story is scary because it says something about the human condition that I think is very hard to articulate in a lot of other ways. It says something about how, as the person that you are not immune to propaganda. You are not immune to being manipulated into doing something, even if you think you are. Because it's all well and good to say, oh yeah, I'm going to quit smoking, I'm going to quit drinking, I'm going to quit doing whatever, and then 3 weeks later you're doing it again and it's not quite as important. Obviously, I would not advocate this horrific treatment to get someone to stop quitting smoking, but I think it says something about the extreme lengths that you would need to go to separate yourself from humanity enough to be a person that is immune to propaganda. And I think that's scary, honestly. I think that's really scary. I really like that story for how chilling it is. And as with a lot of these short stories, it ends with that, not a twist as such, but the concerning note of, oh God, his wife is missing her little finger. That must mean, you know, he put some weight on and they chopped a finger off. Oh my God, that's terrifying. The thing that really sticks with me about the story, though, is the idea that they refer to themselves as pragmatists. Rather than anything else, they have no qualms about what they're doing because they have somehow have trained themselves in this way, like I say, to be massively out of humanity, out and away of the rest of the world, such that everything that they do, they view in this, as I say, pragmatic way. It's like, yeah, well, lots of people are happier. Whatever the means are that we make that happen doesn't really matter because people are happier. If life is a balance sheet, then we've succeeded. Okay, thank you and good night. And I think that's... I can only imagine stepping into that office and it feeling like another world. I think that's something really chilling and I loathe thinking about it in the nicest possible way. Again, that was from Night Shift by Stephen King. It's a collection of short stories that are really, really, really good. I would definitely recommend picking up a copy. I think my edition is from the 70s or the 80s or something. 1978, this copy. That's the book. This copy was 1979, okay. So, yeah, it's an old book. You can pick it up on eBay or whatever for £1 or £2. I would really recommend getting it if you like spooky stories. Okay, that is the end of the story, at the end of my inane ramblings about it. Thank you and good night. We're now going to move on to the shilling section of the show, which as we always do, we like to speak a lot about something that matters a lot, and then speak a little about something that matters probably about the same amount. So, first things first, I want to say a big thanks to every single one of our patrons. If this is somehow your first time listening to the podcast, this isn't most of what the show is. Most of the show is Danny and I talking about movies, talking about pop culture, talking about things that have happened in the news that have caught our eye. So, do listen to some of the other episodes if it's your first episode, and if it's not, then let us know. But people for whom it is certainly not their first episode would be our patrons. And we just want to say thank you very much to all of them, because they allow us to make the show that we adore making so much. I'm just going to say thank you to Natalie, Dougie, Aditya, Peter, Darius, and Chloe. Thank you very much, one and all. You really do allow us to make the show possible. And just literally right now, I'm emailing back and forth with someone about doing some advertising for the podcast and getting our podcast out there a bit. And I'm using funds that we wouldn't have if we didn't have the patrons. You really do allow us to do this podcast, and that means the absolute earth. So I can only say thank you. Thank you, each and every one of you. It's so incredibly kind, and it really does mean the world to us. Just as a bit of a final note, if you want to see any of the other stuff that Danny and I do, you can go to our link trees. The podcast itself has a link tree as well. Let's start there. You can go to linktr.ee/shoutingintothevoid, and you can go to... hang on, is it Shouting Into the Void? I've got no idea. Let me check. Yes, it is. Well, hey, okay, we figured it out, everybody. Don't panic. You can go to my link tree, which is linktr.ee/Lewis_Brindley, and you can go to Danny's, which is linktr.ee/O'Hiram. They'll all be in the show notes. You know the deal. You've listened to a podcast before. Well, I hope you very much enjoyed this little spooky story. We're coming up for Christmas now, so I'll have to find some spooky Christmas story or something if we need to do one of these in November. Speaking of spooky Christmas stories, I'm reading a book at the minute called Nos 4R2. That is like, if you were writing on a number plate, that's the... It's written like that. And it's really horrible. I don't really know what it's about, and I've read about 500 pages of it. So if you like spooky stuff and Christmas, because there's a lot of Christmassy stuff in it, read that. But anyway, thank you very much for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you're as freaked out by the weird sort of alien spaceship office as I am. Have a lovely day. Stay hydrated. Be kind. Be silly. Okay, thank you very much. Good night. Thank you.